Welcome to another Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, I'll be talking to one of the great modern directors, Michael Mann, about his latest movie, Public Enemies, starring Johnny Depp as bank robber John Dillinger on the run from Sheriff Christian Bale. I'll be finding out why Michael Mann is obsessed with cops and robbers. Also this week, we'll be delving into the roots of 70s soul with a great documentary on singer Billy Paul. Am I Black Enough For You traces the life and music of this unsung titan of the Philly sound. I'll be talking to the man behind this labour of love, Swedish filmmaker Göran Hugo Olsson. Zan Brooks is back to help me review this week's releases, including Dennis Leary and Simon Pegg popping up in Ice Age 3 and the reissue of a Latin classic, Strawberry and Chocolate, or Fresas y Chocolate. Yes, it's much more fun than being hunted down by Christian Bale and his FBI goons. It's Film Weekly. Director Michael Mann may have come to international attention first with his cool interpretation of the first Hannibal Lecter story, Manhunter, back in 1986. But his early career, from writing credits on TV's Starsky and Hutch to his first features, prison drama The Jericho Mile and The Thief, starring James Caan in 1981, were preoccupied by Mann's passion for the outlaw, for the outsider. He continued these themes in The Last of the Mohicans, Heat, and in a way with The Insider. His latest film, Public Enemies, continues that theme and traces the folkloric legacy of 1930s bank robber John Dillinger, played by Johnny Depp, examining the allure of life lived on the outside.
What is it exactly you do for a living?
John Dillinger robbed banks. Where all these people here put their money.
Why'd you tell me that? You could have made up a story.
I'm not gonna lie to you.
That's a serious thing to say to a girl you just met.
I know you.
Well, I don't know you. I haven't been any place.
Well, some of the places I've been ain't so hot. Where I'm going is a whole lot better. You want to come along?
Boy, you're in a hurry.
If you were looking at what I'm looking at, you'd be in a hurry too.
That's Johnny Depp as John Dillinger charming the coat check girl, Billy Frichette, played by Oscar winner Marion Cotillard. When I met up with Michael Mann for my In the Director's Chair series, I started out by asking him if there was something in the blood of every Chicago native that made them support the outsider.
Well, these kinds of stories are kind of endemic. They're native to Chicago. So is the attitude. Chicago's always had a very kind of a tough-minded, kind of great skeptical kind of humor. If you think back to My Girl Friday and Front Page and Hack, then it's kind of a Brechtian kind of a wit on the street in Chicago amongst all Chicagoans. That's not reserved to.
Well, why is that? Because it's not New York, or because it's not L.A., because it's sort of.
Not at all. Chicago has its own identity. It's not the middle of anywhere. Mm. It's a tough. It's a very beautiful city, physically very beautiful city, and it's a tough city. It's had a tough history, and it's a very strongly populous city. So. It happens to be going through a stage right now, by the way, where it's probably the best run and most physically beautiful city in America. Mm-hmm. If anybody walked down the street just about anywhere in that city and put graffiti on the walls, the citizens would interfere. I mean, it's a really
because in your new film, you use it to its kind of shiniest and I suppose most grand, harking back to that 30s era.
In this film, it harkens back to the brick streets and brick buildings and that reality, and it very much occurs in a neighborhood that I grew up in. I drove past the Biograph Theater with my father, and when I was a little kid on Lincoln Avenue, and said, "Oh, there's the Biograph. That's where they shot John Dillinger." I said, "Who's John Dillinger?" As a 7, 8, or 9 year old, And so it's a neighborhood not just of the physically, but also culturally. Mm-hmm. Dillinger was admired. He was a kind of a folk hero in his time, and that's absolutely there's nothing remarkable about that to Chicagoans.
Many of your films, they do involve a cop and a robber. They involve the fugitive from justice and the justice.
My films involve conflict. Mm-hmm. In the case of Public Enemies, There is a catastrophic, from the FBI point of view, a catastrophic shootout that occurred at a lodge in the far northern woods of Wisconsin called Little Bohemia. And we went and shot in the real place. That is the real place that actually happened.
Right,
the original bullet holes are still in the walls. And so would we probably tuned it down in terms of what happened, how long it went on. But the real magic isn't guns going off. That anybody could have guns going off. The real magic is that when Johnny Depp, playing John Dillinger, is asleep in that bed and the FBI assault begins, Johnny Depp is in the same, literally the same bed in the same room as John Dillinger was. And it turned out that coincidentally, I didn't realize this at the time, it was the same day. It was April 22nd. We shot it on April 22nd, and it occurred on April 22nd.
One of the things that you have brought to each of your films is a sort of new way of telling, I suppose, age-old stories in a way. Especially with Public Enemies, you've used a kind of very actual camera style. And a very actual kind of aesthetic, I suppose. Given that this genre, the kind of, I suppose, if we go hark back to the 30s itself, gangster pictures, noir pictures, have kind of, we've seen all those styles before. You created something new, I think, which is that something that you start off thinking, well, how do I reinvigorate this whole genre?
Exactly. I don't start off thinking, how do I invigorate a genre? Because I'm not conscious of the genre. What I'm conscious of is my story.
Right.
And I ask myself as a very early stage, you know, how do I want this story to tell itself? How should the story tell itself? And where do I want to locate the audience? I want to impact on the audience. I don't make films for myself. I don't do, it's that kind of onanism. How do I want to impact on the audience? And how should the story do that? And I wanted to bring audience into I didn't want audience to passively look at the period. I wanted the audience in the period. I wanted them in 1933. I wanted them intimate to Dillinger, as if they're standing right next to him, and this is happening right now today. And that reality on some Tuesday afternoon at 2:11 in Sioux Falls, when they're coming out of a bank, is happening just as if it would happen to you walking out of a store, and suddenly you're in the midst of an unnecessary, in this case, gunfight that begins during a bank robbery that's just happening. And so that determined everything. It determined the lighting, it determined the look, it determined where the cameras are, it determines everything once you decide that. So the key decision was I wanted the audience, as much as I'm capable of doing, to feel like they're right there.
Yeah.
They're right there, they're right in it, happening.
So your decision was that modern audiences would equate this look, is it a high def look?
High def is kind of a verite feel. It has an immediacy to it. I mean, it brought it a bit closer to it. I shot some tests side by side in Los Angeles. It was at night, black 1933 Buick, some people dressed up in some wardrobe, the kind of brick walls that we'd have in the movie. It happened to be raining that night, and I actually planned to shoot the film on film. And so we had a film camera set up, and I said, no, let's bring a Sony F23 camera in too and shoot them side by side. And I looked at it, and it was an instant decision. I mean, because in the film, it looked like a film. It looked like a motion picture of a period motion picture. And I looked at it in video, I felt I'm there.
Yeah, so. Well, you certainly did new things with Public Enemies.
Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure, because you're always doing new things. So I always look forward to a Michael Mann film, and Public Enemies is no different. So congratulations, and thanks for coming on in the director's chair.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Mann there, and Public Enemies is released in the UK unusually from Wednesday, the 1st of July. You can, of course, catch a video cut of that interview with Michael Mann by going to my Director's Chair series on guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. Now, speaking of outlaws and Britain's Most Wanted, I'm joined by Zan Brooks to review some of the week's releases, including, of course, Public Enemies. We heard from Michael Mann there, Zan. He makes a sort of impassioned defence of himself, of putting himself grittily in the 1930s, like as Dillinger lived it himself. Does that work, the look that he's gone for here?
I think so. I think that was one of the strengths of this film for me, that it almost catches an America on the cusp of the modern age, that it's still the kind of the lawless Wild West. And yet you have these sort of big cities that have been thrown up that have these big imposing neoclassical banks that they can go and rob. And then they hop in a car and like 5 minutes later, they're in the wilderness and they're in the forest. And there's this sense of America just beginning to move into the modern world. And it's the modern media technology and popular culture. And
I think the thing you realise about this film, as soon as you watch it, you go, well, it doesn't look like a kind of old-fashioned gangster.
Not at
all. Production values are kind of low, but I'm assuming they're also kind of high.
Yeah, and I think that the temptation with a film like this would be to shoot it on a sort of static camera and have the big tableaus and the big kind of, you know, the big sweep of the period setting.
Yeah.
Whereas the handheld camera, I thought, really worked for me. It gave it an immediacy, and it did put me in the kind of the picture, I think.
Yeah, certainly when they're running through the forest bit and Christian Bale's doing his shooting and that, you really did feel like, God, it wasn't as glamorous as perhaps those kind of old gangster movies make it seem.
No, not at all. I mean, it's a sort of grubby world that it does capture. There's a lot of just sort of hanging out in little log cabins and just running and guns going off and slightly misfiring. And it's a messy business, and it does catch that.
I like Johnny Depp kind of striking a pose, and I think he's got a good kind of 1930s face, if you like. He always has a good face for whatever era it is. Just didn't kind of get to know his character very much.
No, and I wonder if that might have been slightly intentional. It wasn't a film that was a character study of anybody, really. I mean, it was a big cast of characters, and they're almost like kind of gangster archetypes that he's dealing with. So you never really get to know these people, but maybe that was true as well, because they're living on the run. They've got no backstory almost. All they are cops or robbers.
I just thought that this film, at no point did it really take off for me. As you say, it's a solid piece of work, and I enjoyed it. But for a summer blockbuster, which kind of has got to kind of defeat the might of the Transformers and Star Trek, I kind of just wanted a little bit more at some point. Maybe a dance number, the Jazz Age kind of coming into it.
Oh, it's got a good soundtrack to it, though. It's got good bluegrass.
It's very
bluegrass,
a nice Billie Holiday.
Yeah, Holiday in there.
A Diana Krall singing Bye Bye Blackbird. I just wish it wasn't
maybe
Diana
not.
Krall.
This, I mean, it's one of those. The bad thing about this film, I think, for me, was that it started better than it ended. I thought that the first half an hour was great, where you were just plunged into this world with the handheld camera and the chases through the forests and trying to work out who was who underneath the sort of the big hats that they were all wearing, trying to get the measure of this universe that Michael Mann had created. Once you'd got the universe, then it becomes a slightly more plodding, traditional gangster film. And in that way, it worked fine. I really enjoyed it. But I agree, it doesn't achieve the level of real greatness.
Yeah, and they show, I mean, because famously Dillinger died watching a gangster film called Manhattan Melodrama, played by Clark Gable, who was based on a character of John Dillinger himself. So there's that little play going on there. And I just thought, when they showed quite a little bit of Manhattan Melodrama, I kind of thought, I wish this was one of that.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
And just slightly disappointed, whilst I did enjoy it, and I think it's a very interesting piece of work. That's Public Enemies by Michael Mann, starring Johnny Depp. We liked it, so go and see it. You'd advise anything.
I would give it a good, solid 3 stars, shading 4.
Yeah, exactly. Which is not huge thumbs up, but it's certainly a sheriff star thrown off a lapel and into the night. Ice Age 3, Zan, now. I got a feeling that this probably isn't the same audience that Michael Mann was going for. Ice Age 3, of course, 3D, as it is these days. Did you have to don the goggles? Because I didn't see this, so you're going to have to tell me what I missed.
Yeah, I had to don the goggles for this one. And the goggles this time didn't irritate me as much as they have tended to in the past
six months.
Right,
they had nice little foamy bits.
No, it's more what I saw through the goggles. What I'm finding annoying about this whole 3D thing is that the 3D aspects, it's almost like the film is chasing the 3D technology. So it's kind of, what can we use the 3D for? So let's have a boulder throwing out of the screen. And all of that actually becomes really tiresome.
Eyes popping on a little marmoset.
Yeah, and there's only so much of that you can see before you actually think, am I watching a film here or am I just watching the 3D?
Unfortunately, on Film Weekly, we can't bring over the magnificence of the extra dimension in Ice Age 3D. We can only
is
bring
this
you...
not going out in 3D?
No, unfortunately not. Orally, people can kind of see us and me and you. I think we're larger than life, perhaps.
We are, yeah.
But I wonder that the voice worker in these films is all we can bring you. So we're going to bring you Simon Pegg doing London. Now, Simon Pegg is from London, but you'd never know it from this.
What are you doing here?
Our friend was taken by a dinosaur.
Well, he's dead. Welcome to my world. Now, go home.
Off you pop. Not without Sid.
Ellie, wait. Maybe the deranged hermit has a point.
Manny, we came this far. We're gonna find him.
I got tracks.
Gorblimey, is that Simon Pegg?
That is Simon Pegg as the obligatory ducking and diving Cockney rat, who is actually, I have to say, one of the less successful characters in Ice Age 3D, which I did quite like.
Of course you did.
The, you know, what I was saying about the 3D, this felt like it was a film. The 3D was a total sideline.
Yeah.
Also, it's kind of nice to see an animation that's pitched totally at kids.
Right.
It really wasn't going for the knowing humour and the let's get the adults in too with lots of
right, so there's
jokes.
No little kind of rat coming on
not
and doing
all.
A Johnny
this
Depp.
This is a film for 7-year-olds.
Yeah, brilliant. Has he got the well, who's the classic character? Scratch, is that his name?
He's back. Scrat is back. Scrat is back. Voiced again by Chris Wedge.
How are all the voices in this? Because John Leguizamo always doing all
he's
that.
He's great. John Leguizamo is fantastic as the sloth. Dennis Leary as the saber-toothed tiger. Who's having a sort of midlife crisis and feels he has to leave his friends and go off and be a tiger again. I'm worried that I'm overselling this. It's not great. But if you've got a bored 7-year-old, drag them along to this and they'll be purely entertained.
That's Ice Age 3. 3D. So we're going to move on to Cuba now, a rather different tenor of film, because we've got Strawberry and Chocolate, Fresa y Chocolate, a film by Tomas Gutierrez Alea, a film that was nominated for the Best Foreign Language Oscar in 1994. It takes us into Havana in 1979, where Diego, a gay man, is declaring his love for David, a straight man.
Me voy del país.
¿Ah, sí?
¿Qué hace? No es como piensas, coño. No me voy y me votan.
¿Cómo que te votan? ¿Quién te vota?
Posición de Germán. Las cartas que mandé, no sabes el pueblo que tomó todo eso.
Por eso no votan a nadie.
¡Ah, no! ¡Mira!
So that was a little flavor of Jorge Perugoria and Vladimir Cruz in Fresas y Chocolate. That's a film from Cuba. Have you been to
speaking
Cuba?
Speaking a different language.
Muchas gracias.
No, I've never been to Cuba. I'd like to go to Cuba.
I would as well, especially after seeing this.
Really?
Yeah. I thought this was one of the best kind of depictions of Cuba I've seen. There was a couple of people in the bunch I saw it with who've been to Cuba. And apparently when you go, you get your Lonely Planet and you do your guide. And it's full of kind of... And this is where they shot the ice cream scene in Fresas y Chocolate.
Oh, right,
and this
okay.
is where, so it's kind of the
so
big film in Cuba.
So it's stitched into the fabric of the place.
Yeah, which I thought was strange because it's, you know, it's got a gay character.
Yeah, it's pretty critical.
It's quite subversive. It's more eye-opening about Cuba than... I've just rewatched the two Che's of Benicio del Toro and Steven Soderbergh. Che 1 and 2, which you don't learn anything about Cuba itself.
No, I mean, I guess if you're going to compare it to anything, it's Before Night Falls, the Julian Schnabel film, which was about homosexuality in Cuba.
With Johnny Depp
this
as a cross-dressing prison guard.
Because it... Yeah, Johnny Depp gets everywhere, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he's clever.
This, I guess because it was made within Castro's Cuba, has to tread a lot more carefully. It is a film about sexual politics and about the relationship between politics and sexuality. But it's very decorous and light on its toes. And it is about a seduction, but it's more about a kind of an intellectual seduction as opposed to a physical seduction.
That's right. There's even a book that at one point the character Diego, who's clearly gay from the start because he's quite camp, and he gets a book down on Marxist sexuality and reads
yeah.
out the fact that 60% of men have had homosexual inclinations at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
It reduces sex to a kind of governmental
formula.
Statistic.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the other great thing from the other side of the coin in terms of how to tell if someone's gay is from the title where David says that he knew that Diego was gay straight away because chocolate ice cream was on offer, but he still ordered strawberry ice cream.
That's
and
right.
That's just, you know... That's it, isn't it?
And the climax of the film is like, will you take the strawberry or will you take the chocolate
yeah.
in the future? But I thought it was a really good look at Cuba, the kind of dilapidated houses, the former grandeur, the streets, and the people just passing by. That's really kind of what interested me, apart from the interplay between the two characters, which is rather gorgeous.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful kind of evocation of Cuba and Havana in particular, and also just the vibrancy of it. I mean, I know that's a cliche, but just the intelligence and the aspiration of these people
yeah.
who are living quite impoverished lives but are so kind of rich in terms of what they want, what they're learning, and from very little kind of reference points have basically created their own world around them.
In a new way, I didn't realise that it was quite like this because they have, well, you thought under Castro, we thought, well, they have kind of blighted, kind of impoverished lives. They're still sort of having fun. They still can go out and have drinks. They still kind of, but then there's all this kind of political informing. It's like David has to go and say, well, I've met this guy and he might be a bit arty. And he tells his mate who says, right, we're going to tell him the party, you get 10 years for being sort of basically arty and drinking Johnny Walker, which is a
foreign import? How does he get that? How does he get these Maria Vargas Llosa books? There's all this kind of seeping kind of political discontent going on, this kind of Cold War thing.
There's that very odd marriage, I guess, and Cuba is almost a sort of a petri dish for that, of sort of Soviet-style totalitarianism in a Latin culture, which would seem to be an anathema. And Cuba, for some reason, has managed to keep those tensions together for 50 years now. And this is a film that really does explore that dichotomy very nicely and very subtly, I think.
This director, Tomas Gutierrez Alia, is Cuba's greatest director. I'm looking at his filmography here. He's made like sort of 40, 50 films, which I just didn't know about. The only one I've seen before is Memories of Underdevelopment, yeah. Memorias de Sobrecepada.
Very good.
And I really enjoyed that, but that was a pre-revolutionary film about an intellectual kind of caught up in as the revolution happened, doesn't quite know, a sort of middle class,
which I think is autobiographical, because from what I've read about Elia, he was a big supporter of Castro at the time, and then has gradually become disillusioned. I mean, he's dead now, and this I guess was his final break from revolutionary Cuba, or at least his criticism of it.
Yeah, no, it's I thoroughly recommend it. It plays as part of a Cine Cuba season down at the Barbican, along with Soy Cuba, which I think is probably the greatest Cuban film of all time, made by Russian cameramen. And look at Cuba. Cine Cuba is at the Barbican all of this month. Zan Brooks, lovely to see you. If you do want to read any more of Zan's opinions, go to the world's finest film website, guardian.co.uk/film.
Billy Paul is definitely a leader in that school of more or less jazz-based vocals singing pop. He didn't do a lot of screaming. His voice was very velvet, very silk. And the fact that the smooth, calming voice was saying some of the most militant shit ever.
Quite right, sir. That is Questlove from Philly rap outfit The Roots talking about Billy Paul, who's the subject of a new documentary this week, Am I Black Enough For You? Billy Paul represents for me the perfect combination of music and message, and that's also at the heart of the new documentary made by Swedish filmmaker Göran Hugo Olsson, who joins me on the line from Sweden now to tell me about Am I Black Enough For You?
Thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
That's all right. Well, I saw the film. I love Billy Paul. When I saw that you've made a film about Billy Paul, I thought, great, you never get to see anything about Billy Paul. It's actually kind of difficult to find out about Billy Paul. Was that your starting point as well? He's a bit of a mystery, isn't he?
Yeah, very much so. And, he's a great man, of course, and I didn't know that, but I love the sound of his voice, and it meant so much to me. And he was very hard to find, and that, you know, kept me, you know, looking for him and get curious.
That's right. I suppose everyone knows Me and Mrs. Jones as well, which is a beautiful soul song. I mean, lovely example of his voice. But his songs, as you say, they go from people having affairs in Mr. and Mrs. Me and Mrs. Jones. They go to Am I Black Enough For You and Let's Clean Up the Ghetto. Real strong social kind of, I suppose, what you call militant soul at the time. Yeah. It reminds me of sort of Gil Scott-Heron, slightly less jazzy, that kind of era. Yeah. To love songs, to a cover of Elton John's Your Song, which I think is a beautiful cover version. Yeah. What was he like as a person? Is he still political? Because I got the feeling that when you asked him about the song, Am I Black Enough For You, he was worried that perhaps he hadn't been black enough. I got the feeling perhaps he felt he'd sold out a bit.
This is very hard to, you know, to get a straight answer, because Billy is in that position that he have a social consciousness, but he also want to be an entertainer, a performer. I think his role model is Sammy Davis, that has some, you know, but it's not overshadowing the performance. And he wants to be a performer, basically. But he came in that time that, you know, and he was obviously also used by Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff for more harder social issues.
They were the political agitators, and they were using him in the black exploitation era. They were slightly exploiting him, and I guess that's why he feels a bit like he didn't want to talk about them initially.
Exactly. And I remember the one of the things with Phyllis, it came after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King and everything, so it had an edge to it that Motown and Memphis sound did not. So,
as a documentary, it's an interesting film, isn't it? Because I get the feeling that you're a big fan of Billy Paul as well. Yeah. And one could have been harder in your documentary. But I noticed that you sort of say that one of my favourite films of all time, Bruce Weber's Let's Get Lost, about Chet Baker, was your model for this. Why did you choose that one as the Uber doc?
It was more like an inspiration, and I'm not sure if this is very smart because it's so iconic, it's so good, and it's very hard to say how it works. I love it, and I wanted to make a nice film about Billy. I wanted to pay back, not only to Billy, but to Kenny Gamble and all the Philadelphia musicians that, you know, created this music. I analyzed Bruce Weber's masterpiece, and I try to draw inspiration from that kind of, you know, documentary. Though they have a stronger narrative structure in Let's Get Lost, and of course the ending is very, you know, makes it so strong.
Thankfully you don't have the same ending yet.
No,
but what you do have Barack Obama in the White House as well. So I suppose that Billy talks about
I didn't want to do that. I think the time is over when you expect a documentary to be, you know, hard hitting, more journalistic, you know, Nick Broomfield, and you storm in and stir up things and so on. I wanted to make a film that corresponded to the Philadelphia soul with a consciousness, but also nice. And it's shot entirely on film, not on video. It's not a single frame of video in the film, except from the Grammy Award when Ringo hands over the Grammy. But
so all that stuff in the back of the car, where that wonderful interview where she's telling how they met, and he's just eating a hamburger, looking like quite under that. Because I thought maybe you'd used it almost shot it on a mobile phone. That's on film, is it?
It's on Super 16. So, but it was very, very dark. So, but I wanted to have another decision we made. Was that everything in the film except for one scene that we couldn't handle is made after dark to get the solar, more, you know, 70s warmer feeling.
Yeah, which is how Philly Soul sounds, isn't it?
Yeah,
that warmth.
So I didn't want to have this whitewashed daylight and video stuff. So that was kind of the creative decision that actually it was very hard to handle,
to pull off. You make a decision and you think, why did I do this? Why didn't I just go on video? But you know what? I think it really works, Joran. And you know, if anything else, it's going to open up a whole, I think, audience to Billy Paul and his politics and Am I Black Enough for You? And if nothing else, it certainly sent me scrabbling to the secondhand record shops. I've bought 360 Degrees of Billy Paul. I've bought a Philly compilation that I never had. And I've also bought The Very Best of Billy Paul, all because of your CDs, all because of your film this week. So, you know, sales
that
of Billy Paul
happy.
Are going up. That's what it's for, isn't it, surely?
Yeah, sure.
So he's going to be ahead of Michael Jackson in the CD charts.
Wow.
Joran, Hugo Olsen, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly, and congratulations on your film, Am I Black Enough for You?
Thank you, and cheers, and have a nice day. And I used to sit and wonder why,
babe. My thanks to Joran Hugo Olsen there, and the music featured in this week's podcast was, of course, taken from his fine documentary, Am I Black Enough For You?, which is released here in the UK from Friday, July the 3rd. Well, that's all for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Film Weekly via iTunes. Just hit the subscribe button or at guardian.co.uk/film. We're determined to head up those iTunes charts and we need your help to do so. So do that. Press the button. Off you go. You can join us on Facebook, Film Weekly Fans. It is our moniker. And do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer to read my legendary trailer trash column, and all the best film news and reviews are in there too. For now, for this week from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. Don't think twice, it's all right.